Hey, this is going to be the hardest one, obviously, because we're full of fried chicken and ribs, and hey, those weren't bad ribs. I'm a barbecue snob. I'm from the South originally, and so in Colorado we don't do really good barbecue or Mexican food. The place that was voted consistently the best barbecue in Denver is a chain from Birmingham, Alabama. So that just shows you kind of what we're dealing with. And so this is impressive. Congrats. This is a good congrats to the Great Northwest. You guys have got some barbecue. Hey, we're going. Let me give you the big picture. We're talking about how to lead the church on mission, how to lead the church in an ever expanding, increasing, growing mission that enfolds more people into God's kingdom. We're talking about how to have a vision and a life that that lends itself to that. We're talking about the reality that we often get stuck at places along the way, and when we get stuck, that probably if you're frustrated, it's that you're starting to lose hope that there's more, that God has more for you and for your church. And there's something to be said for contentment with whatever he's assigned you, but there's also something to be said for kind of a holy discontent that we would want to see more people saved into his kingdom. We would want to see more people discipled. We would see more people's lives renovated and put on mission. So I think if you're feeling like a holy discontent, that's a really good thing. And we're talking about how do you lean into that discontent so that you don't just kind of settle in and just play out the string hopelessly, but that you lean into that tension. And so we said that there's a habit that we have to learn, which is really an emotional habit, a way of being, as much as it is a technique, and that is that we differentiate from the norm in order to lead movement and to lead, and we have to learn how to do that and what that feels like. And so we talked about that. And then we said practically what that can begin to look like is you begin to prioritize and invest yourself into developing leaders who are going to expand the mission of God, whether it be by bringing more people in, whether it be by creating more capacity. And I think that's where you start to get your energy back as a pastor, is when you know that you are, first of all, you're spending your time before anything else gets put on your plate. You're able to spend the time necessary to develop more capacity in your church and to develop leaders who are going to make an impact in the kingdom. And so that's really energizing. And this is what gets me through stuck seasons. I was telling some guys over lunch, We had a season that really was at the beginning of this past year where we said, you know, our church honestly hasn't grown that much in a year, and that for us that doesn't mean that we haven't seen new people come into our body, because Denver's a very transient city, so you bring in a certain number of new people every year just to keep up with the people who have moved away, and so we. You always have new people. Your newcomer classes can have people in them, and yet still overall you don't feel like you're growing or making progress. And so we just looked at our attendance and our group involvement, and we said, on the whole, we haven't grown much in the last year. And so we started to dig down into what that might be telling us about how we're doing ministry. And one of the things that we identified a number of barriers, but one thing we identified was we've had 30 fellowship groups, which is a main way for us of belonging to our church. We've had 30 of those, and we've been at 30 for 18 months, for a year and a half. And we have a guy who leads that for us, and he said, you know, when I started in this job, there were 30 groups, and today there's 31 groups. So we haven't really grown our capacity. We started to ask, what if we grew our capacity? And in fact, he said, you know, all the research I've done and everything I've learned about group ministry would suggest that new groups and new communities are great at integrating new people. And so if we don't expand our capacity, we're not going to be good. We're not even going to be a church that's friendly, much less has capacity for newer people. And so we set a goal to have 50 groups by the first of 2016. So to go from 30 to 50 by the first of 2016, and then that's a leadership development initiative, identifying and developing potential leaders. And so we started on that. In August, we had 41 groups, and the summer is usually a big visitor time for us when we see new people coming through. And so we said by August, let's be ready to roll with some new groups. And we had 41 new groups. We had 41 groups in August. So I guess that's 11 new groups that we had in August. And we start getting people into them. And in 5 weeks, we had 106 new people join a group in a matter of 5 weeks. So this is just speaks to the power of developing leaders. And what was really fun about that was to be able to watch our team prioritize development of leaders, and then to celebrate at the end of that process, to celebrate, hey, we raised up 11 new leadership teams, which is really like, for us, we do team leadership in our group, so to start 11 groups is really the equivalent of raising up 30 to 40 new leaders. We raised up 30 to 40 new leaders. We got them organized into teams, got them ready for mission. And look, God brought 106 people into the life of our church by doing that. That's how you start to get your energy back as a pastor when you feel like you're stuck. And so you start to prioritize investing in developing leaders. Now, in the last section of this, I want to talk about the role of elders in this process. And we've saved elders and elder teams until the end because we want the elders to serve mission. So we don't just want to, the mission of the church is not to develop elders. It's not like we develop some elders, we win. The mission of the church is people being involved in ministry. It's new people being connected. It's lives being given away in the city. By the way, you need tangible and intangible ways to measure success. So you ought to identify your metrics. You ought to have some measurable ways, whether that's number of people attending or number of people in groups or number of leaders developed. You ought to have some things like that you can measure. And then you ought to have some intangible things you identify as wins. And so we're actually in a teaching series right now that we call Signs of Life because we've identified five really intangible, or they're tangible sometimes, but they're not measurable. They're not countable. But it's the stories we want to tell. It's the things we want to see happening. It's stuff we think that the gospel does. So week one we did conversion and we preached on the new birth and we said this: you know, people are born again when the gospel is at work. That's not a sign of life. That's the life that creates everything else. And then we talk about renewal, which is people being spiritually refreshed and people saying, you know, I've been a Christian for a long time, but I feel like God is doing something new in my soul, or I have a fresh appreciation for the gospel or for grace. We want to find those stories and tell those stories. And we said there's a certain kind of community that the gospel creates and that only comes for the power of the resurrected Jesus. And so we want to find stories of the gospel creating that kind of community. We want to tell that. And compassion for us is how we describe the work of mercy and justice, and that the gospel takes people and bends their heart toward the poor and bends their heart toward the marginalized. And so we want to tell stories about that happening. If you don't see that happening, like if we don't see that happening, then we haven't instructed people or something's off in our understanding of grace if we're not seeing people's lives, their money, their time being invested in developing and helping the poor and the marginalized. And then the last one we talked about is new creation, which is how the gospel impacts all of life. So this is marriages being done new. This is parenting. This is people creating a community in their neighborhoods. This is just the normal life stuff that the gospel transforms, and it begins to be little first fruits of the new kingdom that's coming when the creation is made new. So new creation. Those things aren't measurable or countable, but you can identify them. You can find stories, and you need to celebrate those stories when you see them. That's the win for us. So the win is not having elders. The win is not we installed three new elders. But you need to develop elders, and you need to develop teams of elders in order to do all that other stuff well, right? In order to support the mission of the church. So we put this last for that reason, because it is what needs to be done in service of advancing the mission. So what we're going to talk about is developing elders and elder teams, and there's two parts to that. They're both really important. By developing elders, we mean developing men so that they are qualified and ready to be elders in your church. And by developing elder teams, we're acknowledging that elders are spoken of in plurality in the New Testament. So you're going to have a team of elders if you're doing it biblically. You need to be very attentive to the actual dynamics and makeup of that team. So just like if you were assembling a football team, you wouldn't have, you know, you wouldn't have, what's maximum roster size for a college football team? Is it 85? Yep, it's 85. So the maximum roster size in college football is 85. What is it in the NFL? 53. You're not going to have 53 300-pound men, are you? I mean, you're not going to be great as a team if you have 53 300-pound men. But you better have a dozen or so of them that can play on the lines. And you better have some speed guys. And you better have a quarterback. I mean, you know how teams are formed. So it takes a diversity of players. So building a coherent elder team and helping them learn to function as a team is also really, really important. And not just that you have five or you have six or whatever the number is. So we're going to talk developing elders, and then we're going to talk developing elder teams and helping the men who are elders learn to function together in a coherent team. All of this in service of the mission, okay? So developing elders. The first thing when you're to do is to developing elders is to identify what the starting point is for the men that you want to develop. Like, where do you want them to be when you start an intentional process of developing them for eldership? And here's why I'm raising this question. I think if you're doing the other stuff we talked about, especially the second session, if you're doing leadership development, I think your starting point for the men you're going to develop to be elders can be pretty close to elder qualified. You ought to have a lot of men who are growing up in the life of your church. They're leading their homes well. They're leading their families well. They're doing marriage well. They are respected in the community. They're thought well of by outsiders. They're hospitable. You ought to have guys whose character is being shaped. You ought to have a lot of guys who are close to elder ready. In fact, the thing that might distinguish them is from being elder ready is theology. Or theological vision. And I actually think it's a lot easier for that to be the last thing you develop. So I get a sense that where we've kind of been culturally as a network is that we find guys who really love theology and have learned theology, and then we try to teach them how to be elders, right? And we attract we hadn't just ridden the wave of, we've been really tied into and part of the Young Restless Reformed movement, which I think is awesome. I think a revival of doctrines of grace, biblical theology, gospel-centered theology, reformed theology, I think that revival is healthy for the evangelical movement in America. We've been part of that as a network. But if anything, we get young guys that are attracted to that because they're attracted to it for good reasons. I am this guy. I was discipled. I came to faith at 16 years old. My formative discipleship experience was really college and campus crusade. I was discipled into a very minimalistic theology, just kind of like, Jesus loves you, he died for you, now get busy, right? Okay. Oh, he rose again too. We're not sure how that fits, but that's important. And get busy, right? Get out there and witness for Jesus. And I was kind of raised in that. And then to get theological training and education and to dive into this was like, it was life-giving to me. It was like, oh man, this faith has so much more substance to it than I ever thought. For me, that came when I went to seminary, and I remember being kind of angry when I started seminary, that I had to spend $40,000 and go to seminary in order to get taught some of this stuff, right? I thought I should have been taught this in the church. So I love our tribe because we are reaching young men with a great theological vision. Where we have to be careful, though, is that we don't make theological sophistication the lone mark of eldership, and then we're just trying to teach men who are deep theologically, we're trying to teach them how to be mature men and leaders, right? So I think it's actually easier if you go in the opposite direction, if you get men whose their character is formed into the qualifications of elder. They are living a life on mission. They are walking with God. They can lead. They can think organizationally, and they can lead an organization. And then those guys, if you find that they need some theological development, that's the easiest thing to do in the world. Their hearts are receptive to it because they're disciples. They're learning. They're growing. So I would start. I've learned that the hard way, and I'll tell you that story in a minute of kind of how we developed elders. But when we finally figured that out, that we should take good men and then give them theology, we now have more men qualified for elder than we can actually really use in our current model. But in fact, we have some new elders, and our best guys are guys who a year and a half ago, they couldn't have told you what Reformed theology was. Now, they love it today, but they couldn't tell you. I just sat them down with books and made them start reading. But they were already discipling people. They were already leading well. They were already thinking about the mission of our church. And then the theological piece is something you can add. So we're going to talk about developing men to be elders. And you have to identify what your starting point is. And I think if you're doing overall leadership, development, and discipleship in your church well, that the starting point can be pretty close to elder qualified, with the missing piece perhaps being that they could really explain and articulate and understand your theological convictions and your theological vision. You might need to add that and really train them intensely on that. Okay, so I think a good picture of what elders do. I love the qualification passages in Paul's letters in Titus and in 1 Timothy 3. But I think Peter's little description in 1 Peter 5 is a real concise target to shoot for. So in 1 Peter 5, he goes, "I exhort the elders among you as a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as a partaker in the glory that is going to be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you, not for shameful gain, but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock." Now, the way this reads, shepherding the flock is like the big category over that for elders. And then he starts to go, how do you shepherd? What does it mean to shepherd? Well, it means to exercise oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, not for shameful gain, but eagerly, not domineering over your charge, but being examples to the flock. But there's three ideas here that are really important. I think shepherding the flock of God, not domineering over them, but being examples, and then exercising oversight are three big categories for what elders do. So you can use this as a lens now for what you need to develop men toward to be elder ready. So let's take not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples. I think being examples is consistent with many of Paul's qualifications and not domineering over. Like if you think not domineering over, but being an example, and then you go back and read above reproach, husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, might be more in the shepherding category, not a drunkard, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. I mean, this is a guy who's an example of what it means to follow Jesus. So a lot of what I'm saying is I think you can get guys to this point through just the normal discipleship and leadership development initiatives of the church where you're already confident that they're a good example of what it means to follow Jesus. So you should, if you're doing leadership development well in the life of your church, you shouldn't have to take a guy who's rough around the edges, he knows a lot of theology, but he's not yet a great example, and go, well, let's try to make him an example, a good example, right? He should already be a good example of what it means to follow Jesus before you ever start developing him toward eldership. The key here is a man's heart. So when we talked about the levels of leadership development, it's really that his heart is being transformed by the gospel. That's what makes him an example. It's not just his behavior. It's ultimately where his heart is. Okay, second category, shepherd the flock of God that is among you. You probably, again, can look for men who are already doing work of caring for and shepherding people. Now, you might need to, if you're beginning to look at them through the lens of eldership, you might want to give them some other ways to shepherd so that you can watch them shepherd people. So ways that we have found to do that include things like new member interviews, like helping them do interviews for new members, having them sit in there, talk with new members, hear their stories, talk about their testimony. Then we can kind of go, are you kind of sensing what we need to be looking for? We're looking for professions of faith. Another area that we're kind of on the front end of developing that we think is great for our elder candidates is we have a pastoral care team that's not just our elders, but our elders have appointed that we have a kind of some pastoral counselors, for lack of a better term. So we have a system of pastoral care, and we have both men and women who work on that team of pastoral care and counseling, because sometimes women need to meet with women on women's issues. They're more comfortable men with men. And all that's overseen by our elders. Our elders participate in that, but we have some other people who do that. So we can begin to bring men who might be elders. We can begin to give them some pastoral care responsibility through that system, or they can come alongside one of our elders and do it through that system. So we begin to see how they would shepherd people. You can give them teaching in smaller venues. So we'll take our elder candidates and we'll say, why don't you come teach? We have a class called First Step, which is for non-Christians and people who are like brand new to faith, and like, how do you take first steps of faith? We'll invite them in to teach that, or to help teach that alongside one of our other elders. We have a class for new people to the church. We'll invite them in to teach a little portion of that. Here, why don't you teach one 30-minute session? We call that class Next Step. Why don't you teach one 30-minute session of the Next Step class? We'll kind of watch you and give you some feedback on it, okay? So you can give them smaller venues to teach in. You can give them preaching responsibility, and that doesn't just have to be your main service. We have a lot of church plants we're friends with, and I'll farm our young guys out to fill the pulpit at some of the newer church plants, and then I'll go show up and take notes and listen to them and then give them feedback on how they're doing. So all these ways you can develop guys in their shepherding gift. A key here is probably going to be the theological vision or theological vision training. In order to be able to teach, in order to be able to shepherd with intelligence, they're going to have to begin to have some theological vision. Now, if they've experienced heart transformation, they're going to be pretty good at shepherding, because they know experientially what it's like to be transformed by the gospel at a heart level, so they can begin to lead people into that. You just want to now give them categories and language and all that to describe and to work with people on that. And then the third category is exercising oversight. And when we're preparing men for eldership, this is a big one we have to prepare them on. And by that I mean the big picture vision and direction of the church. So this includes anything that is in your theological vision. That's how your theology gets fleshed out, and your theology and your understanding of culture gets fleshed out in practice. This is anything that's unique to your DNA as a church. So I actually think there's men who if you read Paul's qualifications for elder, you would probably go, yeah. But they may not be great on the elder team of your church if your church has some distinctives you've worked out over time in terms of how you do ministry and what you value and what's important. So you need to train them in those things. You need to decide, where do we want our elder team to be unified, and where are we willing to have a diversity opinion? And you need to decide where those thresholds are for you. And then you need to equip them toward the areas that you want elders to be unified in, and you need to screen for that. So we've had men who have thought about being elders who, on one or two distinctives that we don't want to be an ongoing debate in our church, they weren't sure that they could embrace it at that level. So we're like, that's great. We're glad you're a member here. You don't have to be a member to embrace that, but like, we're going to lead together out of that kind of conviction. So you need to decide what those things are. And the key to this is to be able to, you feel in your gut, they're us. They fit us. Okay, now let me just, to make this a little bit more specific, let me tell you how we've done this in our life. And we have an elder team of seven right now. We've had 4 iterations of our elder team in our 9 years. In our first phase, it was just we had 2 founding elders of the church. So from hit the ground through the first year of life as kind of a gathered church, it was just the 2 of us as elders. The first thing we brought 1 non-staff man onto our elder team. And we identified 1 guy in our church who, in his case, he was an older man, and he had been an elder in a church previously. He kind of came to us, in a lot of ways, pretty ready-made. And we spent 9 months with him fleshing out for him our theological vision. Not just our theology, but how that informs everything we're doing as a church, our posture toward culture, all that. And a big point with him was he had come from a more traditional background. He was a Colorado native, which was great. He got our culture. He come from a more traditional background. He and his wife had never lived in an urban area like we lived in, so the cultural acclimation for him was pretty steep learning curve, and he had to really learn how we felt like we needed to do ministry in this particular culture. So we had tons of conversations about that with him for 9 months. At the end of 9 months, this was reading, this was talking. He was like, guys, I am so on board with what you're doing. And his posture was, I just want to help do what you guys know what you're doing. I just want to be as helpful as I can. So we invited him onto our elder team. He runs a pretty good-sized business, so he had some organizational leadership understanding that was really valuable to us as we were starting to hit growth curves, right? And so, a great man, an example. And so that team of 3 led our church for several years, for 4 years. That team of 3 led our church for 4 years. Then we decided we wanted to grow our team, and we really became convicted. We wanted to move toward an elder team that was majority non-staff. We figured that it develops a level of trust with our body. It creates a way for men who are not on staff of the church to have significant responsibility, and that's what we wanted to foster. We had, at the point of 3, we had 2 on staff and 1 not, and so we said, let's begin to develop some other men for this. Now, we had done a pretty good job up to that point in times of developing leaders who we felt good about as examples to the flock on their character. So we said, let's assess some guys and see where they would be for being elder ready. So we did an assessment process with 4 men in our church, and I kind of stole the Acts 29 assessment process. I gave them a written application that had theological questions, personal questions. It was probably too long, but I gave them a pretty laborious written application, and then we reviewed it, and then we met a couple of times with them and their wives and just assessed kind of where they were, okay? And after we went through that, here's what we had. We had 1 guy who was qualified on character and on example. He wasn't a great theological vision fit for us. And he and his wife actually said, after their time with the elders, they said, you know what? We don't know if we have even been able, it would take a lot of work for us to examine these particular convictions. There's a couple of Reformed theology things that they were not, you know, they just weren't, or if they were uncomfortable with, they were just unfamiliar with. And they said, it would take a lot of time for us to examine these and for the man in particular to examine this. And he was leading a nonprofit ministry at the time. He's started a new one since then. He said, I just don't know if that is what I'm called to do. I think I could be really happy in our church as just a member of the church and have a significant, you know, ministry in the city. We said, great. So he didn't continue on. We had 1 that was, again, a godly example. He was a disciple maker. he had never examined anything theologically. So we said, well, I mean, it's going to take some learning. He's like, yeah, I agree. Like, I feel like way behind where you guys are. I don't need a seminary degree, but I need like more development. We said, great, let's put together a plan to develop you. We put two of them up as elder candidates. And when we do elder candidates, what we do is our elders put the men up in front of the church, and we let you know, and we, you know, some of our church would know them and some wouldn't personally know them, but we tell who they are, and then we have a season, 6 weeks for feedback on, and we ask the question, can you follow their leadership as elders in good conscience? Do you have any concerns about their leadership or anything that prevents you from following them in good conscience? And then we have a way for our church body, our members and our attenders really, to give feedback. And so it's not a voting process, it's a feedback process that our elders then take and evaluate. And one of the guys, everyone was very supportive, and then one of the guys, we had just a few, like 100 people are like, that's great. And then four or five said, well, here's a little immaturity issue that we've just observed. And this wouldn't be a big deal to us if he wasn't being put up for elder. Like, this is something we would just tolerate and, you know, bear with in the normal member. But if he's going to be an elder, like, you might want to know about this. We've experienced him this way. We've experienced his leadership this way. And four people were a consistent enough theme. We said, well, we ought to dig into that a little bit. And so we sat down with him and we decided, you know what? It would be better if you grew in that area before you became an elder. So we put his candidacy on hold. So we installed one elder out of that whole process of assessing men, doing a candidate. We installed one elder out of that process. Now, I don't really, it's not my goal to ever get to a point where I put a guy up as a candidate and then there's some concerns voiced. That's hard for him. I mean, it's not the end of the world. A godly man, which he is, will handle that really well. But I would rather not expose a young man to that kind of potential, you know, humiliation if we don't have to. So there's ways that we could have done that better, that process better. I could have found out the things I found out before I put him up as an elder candidate. So lesson learned. But a process that started with four, and we whittled it down to one. So now we have an elder team of four. And that elder team got us for a couple of years. And then we started developing some more men for elder. And by then we had learned this lesson. The main need that we have to have men that are elder ready in our church is theological training, theological vision, understanding of our particular DNA. So we got a group of four men, and we said, we love your character, we love the fact that you're following Jesus, and that you're all serving in the life of our church. We would like to develop you theologically and with theological vision. And we also spent time working on gospel to heart. Not because we didn't see that stuff already happening in those guys, but we felt like that was a check to make sure that our training with them didn't just become theological, but there were always discussions about what is God doing in your heart? How is the gospel transforming you inside? So we began to do that. We compiled a list of things we wanted to read and study, and we gave it to them on a schedule, and then we met every 3 weeks or so. We'd spend 3 or 4 hours together on Saturday morning just chopping up what they had read. It was all stuff that I had already read, I had already processed, our other elders had already read and processed. We're not doing a ton of prep. We're just showing up early on Saturday morning and chopping it up with them and then meeting with them individually to talk about how they're doing and questions they have and stuff like that. We got to the end of that. That process took us 9 months. We got to the end of that. And what we had done is we had taken four guys who weren't very theologically sophisticated, and in 9 months, they became pretty theologically sophisticated. I mean, they read a ton, and they processed a ton, and we gave them a little written exam at the end so we could kind of see how they could articulate it. And one of them was a really younger guy who we felt like probably just needed to have a little bit more experience leading in the life of our church before we put him up for elder. So we told him that, and he was very receptive to that. He said, great. Give me, you know, 2 years of just leading in this capacity. And we put the other three up as elder candidates. And And the results, we learned our lesson from our mistake the first time around. So we talked to everyone who they had led or been in relationship with ahead of time and said, is there anything, we don't see any red flags, but is there anything we should know? Are there any red flags? We ask them the same questions. Would you support their candidacy? Is there anything that if they were to be an elder, you would say, I don't know about that. It's like something you would absolutely put up with in a friend, but might derail or hurt their eldership. And we really got nothing out of that. We had one minor concern that we chased down that, you know, we didn't think was significant enough to not move forward. So we put them up as elder candidates, and we installed them back at the end of the summer. So I now have a team of seven that's a pretty new team, and now I'm really, we're eldering together, but we're in this huge learning process also of how to be an elder team. And it's the first time I've led an elder team of seven of that size, which is different than leading a team of four, which is different than leading two. So I'm learning a ton kind of in this process too. So I want us to talk about elder teams, but before we do that, does anyone have questions about developing men to be elders? Anything you want to drill down more on there?
When you put them up for candidacy, did you mention it for 6 weeks running to the congregation just because you got new people there each week?
Yeah. And it'll be pretty simple. Like after you introduce them, you have some information available, and you communicate other ways besides just on stage on Sunday. Then I'll just say, hey, reminder, we're in a period of elder candidacy. We have these three men who are elder candidates. If you have input, we'd love to have it. You know, just mention it briefly like that.
What are you doing with your elder team once they're done? Are you, I'm sure your discipleship's not
Yeah.
Done, so like when you get together, do meetings, are you going through a program? Are you studying things together? Like,
yeah. Most of our time spent together is around the work of eldering. But we're always integrating something we're learning together. So just this last couple of weeks, we've been reading together a book on prayer, and we've been reading Bill Hybels' book, Too Busy Not to Pray, because it's like that's like prayer for type A people, right? And so we're reading that together, and just when we get together, we have a few minutes just to discuss, hey, what are you learning from this? How are you applying it? It's nothing real organized and structured, but we'll take 15 minutes and talk about what we're learning together. Yep. I'll describe our meeting rhythm. Most of our meeting rhythm is more around the work of eldering, but it's amazing. We just had an elder retreat this weekend. It's amazing how even if you're all reading something together and you're only taking 15 minutes when you're together to discuss what you're learning from it, it's amazing how that stuff comes up in conversation.
Maybe helpful to describe your relationship between the elder team and the pastoral team.
Yeah.
And how that works.
Yep. In fact, I think that's one of the keys of a good elder team is that they know where they fit organizationally, and that varies as your church changes and grows, and you have when you have more staff, and you have elders. I actually think it's one of the most complex organizations to lead. I mean, most organizations don't have two layers of leadership. The closest thing is a corporation that has a board or a nonprofit that has a board and has staff. But if you want your elders to be shepherds and not just, you know, board guys who kind of check off on things, it gets a little foggy. So you've got to be clear on what's an elder responsibility and what's a staff responsibility. So the way we have broken that down would be that elders are responsible for stewarding the big picture vision and direction of the church and making sure we stay true to it. Any initiative that requires the commitment of significant resources or is going to raise questions about our vision or direction, that has to go through them and be approved by them. And then they deal with messy shepherding issues, for lack of a better term. So we handle a lot of pastoral care through our groups and then through our pastoral care system that involves some staff people, some elders, some lay leaders. There's stuff that can get through that is the particularly messy stuff that the elders need to be involved in. And then they constantly assess the spiritual direction and health of the church. So we have a lot of conversation around, spiritually speaking, where's our church strong, where's our church weak? We bounce it off of our vision and mission a lot. A key habit for us is a planning, is an annual planning process. We have 7 elders, we have a dozen staff, and then a couple more like part-time staff. So here's what the planning process allows us to do. The elders initiate that process. They start it by evaluating the overall health and direction of the church. So they give an evaluation of how the church is doing. They give an evaluation of the staff elders. So myself and the guy, the teaching pastor I started the church with, we get a performance evaluation from our other elders. They evaluate us. Their evaluation of our church can be as specific, or it can be as general as we need to. Our church as a whole doesn't seem like we are passionate about prayer. That came up in one of our evaluations. It can be as general as last year. Something came up. It's like we've gotten a little bit rickety at integrating new people and feeling welcoming to them. So it can be as general as that. It can be as specific as this ministry doesn't seem to be doing what we want it to do, or we have we need to create a new this. It can be specific or it can be general. So we take their feedback, we take their input into our vision and direction, and we give that to our staff. Our staff does the same analysis, and then we give them the elders' analysis. And our staff is responsible for proposing a ministry plan for the year that speaks to those particular issues. Now, some of your ministry plan is always just to continue doing what you're already doing and to make it better. But if there's new initiatives that need to happen, I work up a preaching calendar for the year with all this in mind. So a preaching plan and direction for the year, how we're going to lead through the pulpit. The staff puts together goals and initiatives for every area of ministry they do. This includes any new things they want to start. That goes through planning. That plan then goes to the elders. The elders review it, give input on it, goes back to the staff. They tweak it, and then the elders kind of have final approval on that. Then we budget based on that plan. That budgeting is like the last thing we do. The last two things we do are calendaring and budgeting. So it goes elder initiates with evaluation. That evaluation goes to staff. They make a ministry plan that's goals, objectives for each area of ministry. That then goes back to the elders for input, back to the staff. We come up with goals and objectives. We calendar, we budget. It takes a couple of months to get through that. So we started it. So the elders have started their part of it back at the 1st of September. I think I'm going to move this into the summer next year. But I'm just not smart enough to do that right now. So we started it 1st of September. Next week, the staff starts their portion, and our goal is by 1st of November to have everything fleshed out. Now, here's why that's important. Because once that plan is made, it frees the staff. They don't have to wonder what they're commissioned and what they're not commissioned to do. They are commissioned to run that plan. So if the elders have approved starting of some new initiative, they're commissioned to go do that. They don't have to come back and ask the elders, now, here's how we're going to do it. Is that okay? They're commissioned to create that. The elders can review it. They can look at it. They can always raise a hand and say, hey, we started this thing. I know we commissioned it. The way it's being done doesn't feel like it's a fit to us. They always have the right to do that. But we don't have to work through them to do all the detailed work of ministry. So it frees the staff up. So in the fall, the elders are really speaking into plans and stuff like that. And then after those plans are made, the staff are free to go and to do it, and the elders can then just evaluate how we're doing. Yeah, absolutely. Interrupt. Yeah, we do a one mid-year review, just one mid-year evaluation. That's the formalized part of it. So at mid-year, the elders just look at, they just get the plan out, look at it, and say, are there any questions we have? Is there anything that we see is off track? Is there anything we're noticing? You know, and a lot of times there's not anything.
What if
they're going to initiate something new?
Yeah, do you have a separate mechanism?
Like at mid-year, you mean?
Yeah, because you're setting your
year. Yeah, that's right. We do. So, and this is, I think this is important. There's probably someone who is the bridge between the elder team and the staff team. That's usually the lead pastor. That's me. I'm the bridge. So I referee in some ways. So there's times when I tell the elder team, hey, you're speaking, we already commissioned that. That's not on the table for discussion. We can discuss that in planning process, but like we're not going to stop doing something now. We commissioned that. We had an example of that recently. I'll give you an example. There's also times I tell the staff, "Oh, we can't do that until it goes through the elder." Doesn't mean we won't do something in mid-year. Decide to do something that we didn't put in the planning process. Doesn't mean like once we plan for the year, it's rigid and it's fixed. We could never deviate from the plan. But if they have a significant, not a minor, but a significant new initiative, they can't just launch it without that going through the elder team. And we've had examples where that's happened before. A recent example we had was this. So I told you about the financial challenge we went through, right? So at mid-year, we have this financial shortfall. We got to communicate that to our body. We also decided to cut some areas of spending that we could so that we could cut some money out of our budget. And when we communicate this to our body, we can already say, hey, we've already cut our budget back in kind of some discretionary areas so that we're being as conservative and frugal as we can while we're also asking you to consider giving to help cover this increase. One of the areas that got cut was our worship bands. We have three worship bands, and our worship and arts director had planned for them to produce three EPs, and the money for that got cut in this process. So and our worship and arts director is like our best guy on staff at managing his budget. I mean, he runs a great ship. So he came back and he said, hey, a couple of these projects were already down the road a bit. This is, you know, it's hard to have to cut this down to tell these guys who invested in these projects. What if we did a Kickstarter campaign to raise $6,000-$7,000 so that we can kind of finish these projects? Would that be okay? And I said, I think it's a great idea. He had done all the research. I said, you know, we have examples of other churches having done that. I said, I think that's probably better than us just budgeting money out of the general fund for it. But let me ask the elders to approve that, because I don't want them to see that we have a Kickstarter campaign out there and go, hey, how did that happen? You know, are we raising money a different way? So I took it back to the elders. I said, here's the deal. And a couple of them that we had new elders. They were like, now what's the purpose of having albums? And then this whole conversation started about, is that what we want to be doing? Do we want to be commissioning our worship teams to do albums? Is that a big add to, you know, to the life of our church? Is this mission critical? Like, this whole conversation happened. And I threw the flag. I said, now, that's a fine conversation for us to have, but this was planned for last year. So he was commissioned. Our worship and arts director was commissioned by last year's version of the elder team to do this. So we can't take that. We're not going to take that permission back. All we're discussing is whether we're going to let them do a Kickstarter campaign to finish the goal that they set out to do, or if we're saying because of these budget cuts, that goal needs to be cut. But what we can't do is evaluate if that's a fit and all that. That's not our purpose right now. So that's where you have to just kind of play referee a little bit. I had another thing. I was sitting in church. I was sitting in church one time last year, and it was a Sunday. I'm not preaching, so I'm just sitting there, actually just attending. And our children's director is doing announcements. She's a great leader, good communicator. She's up there doing announcements, and she says, "And coming up two Tuesday nights from this week, we're having our very first Women of Fellowship event. And she gives this big vision for it. And I'm like, what is that? I'd never heard of it. I'd never heard of it before, right? I'd never heard of it before. That was the first time I'd heard of it. Yeah. She says, we're going to have four of these this year. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be great. We're going to have four of these. We're going to talk about what it means to be biblical women and all of this. And I know that every night we rent our building, it costs $2,000. So I just did the math, and I'm like, well, there's $8,000 we just spent before we even, you know, provided all the refreshments. She's up there promising everyone, you know. So I'm doing all the math in my head. And so I do some investigating. And I found out we've had a failure of nerve. And the failure of nerve was my teaching pastor was getting some pressure from his wife and some other ladies to have women's events. And he said, oh, yeah, I'm sure we can do that. And there it was. It was off and running. Now, this is the interesting thing, and this is the position I'm in. They actually had a great vision for the events. And the events aren't a distraction from anything else we're doing. They didn't plan this ongoing program that was going to compete organization with other programs. Trust the ladies who were planning these things. I trust that they're godly women, that there's nothing going to be communicated there that doesn't fit with what I want to be communicated as a church, right? So the vision of the event is fine. But the way it went about getting on our agenda was an organizational mess and not fair to our elders. I mean, I had two elders go, hey, what are we doing with the women's events? I'm like, dude, I don't know. I just heard about them at the same time you did. It's not fair to our elders. It puts us in an awkward position. Now we're the bad guys having to go. Keeping in mind that that's already a sensitive issue culturally in our that women are already suspicious of male headship in our culture. So even to check in on it is going to be to invite suspicion. So I had to have conversations like, dude, you put me in an awful situation right here. Because I'm as an organizational leader, I have to look at this and ask how this came about, but I'm going to take a lot of flack just for asking the question of how it got in the deal. So it breeds unhealth into our body, not because of what it is, but by the way it went about getting in. We could have even midstream, we could have even brought that to the elders and gone, hey, could we approve four women's events at an add of $10,000 to our budget? We actually, that last year, we could have really afforded to do that. It wouldn't have been a bad deal at all. So I said, and it probably would happen. So you have to play referee a little bit. So I did a little reverse refereeing, and we approved the women's events, gave some direction to it, you know. And yeah, that's right. And no, pick your battles, man. And so, but it was like an opportunity to train everyone. It was an opportunity to train everyone on this is how we have to work as a church, as an organization. Okay, so this is just the dynamics you get into when you have multiple layers of leadership and approval. So that's where the planning process is important. And I said this has to go through planning process. I mean, if we're going to commit money of that magnitude to it, it has to go through planning process. And if it doesn't go through planning process, then it has to, you know, it can't just be commissioned by one person on staff, even if he's a founding pastor of the church. So we meet every 2 weeks. We found that monthly is not often enough. Weekly is a lot of elder teams meet weekly. I think that's great. I think that's good. You can always add more, but I think to back off is tough. So I every 2 week rhythm gives our elders enough opportunity to, you know, have significant dialogue, conversation, pray, all that, without having to meet every week. I mean, I don't need a weekly meeting if I don't have to add it to my schedule. We meet every 2 weeks during the peak times of year, which would be like January through May, and then again August through November. We meet, I think we meet once a month in June. We take July off. We take December off. So there's 2 months of the year, July and December, we don't meet at all.
How often do your pastoral care team meet and connect? Who oversees that?
Yeah.
What's that rhythm?
Yeah. Our pastoral care team is overseen by a staff member who is really like an administrator. So what that looks like is we have some men and some women who are trained in a pretty simple model of pastoral counseling. We have a 5-meeting kind of approach to pastoral counseling where we can work someone through an issue in five meetings. We train our pastoral counseling team in how to do that. We have other resources, outside counseling and stuff we can refer people to if they need it. And then we have an administrator of that who does, and now he's a good shepherd. He's a good, like, care for people. He's one of the guys you want doing pastoral care. But he does an intake. We don't call it that publicly because that sounds clinical. But he does a first interview with everyone who's coming through that. And it's a simple phone call. They submit, you know, a request for care. He gets on the phone with them, has some basic questions he asks just to get a feel for what, you know, they're going through or what they need help with. And then he assigns it to one of the pastoral care folks who he thinks would be best to handle that. Everyone has their capacity. So some of our team, the capacity is I can be meeting with one person at a time. That's my capacity. I can be doing one at a time. Some are like, I have room for two at a time. I have room for three. So he knows both who they are, what they're good at, and he knows their capacity, and then he assigns them and gets them connected and then just kind of tracks with the pastoral care provider, tracks with them through the process to see how they're doing, if they need any help or support, keeps it documented. The elders then, he can then give the elders a report at any point of who's in that process and what's going on if they need to.
Can you talk about what an elder meeting looks like?
Yep.
Do you know what that
elder meeting looks like? So it always starts with prayer and devotion for us, and usually we set the agendas a few days in advance. It gets circulated to everyone. So I do that now. I've got another guy I'm working with to be the chairman of the elder board. He will take that responsibility eventually. Gets the agenda set, and that gets circulated to everyone. And then if there's any, you know, usually it's like, this is fine. Anything we want them to look at ahead of the time, we try to get that to them. So preparation, what I'm trying to say is preparation for the elder meeting is actually important. Deciding what we're going to look at, what we're going to discuss, this kind of thing, that's really important. And because you'll see where like, oh, we've got 5 things to discuss and we really only can do 2 of those tonight. Yeah. So you have to make those decisions. And so that preparation is important. Then we always start with a prayer and devotion, and a lot of times our devotion is just, if we're reading something together, we just, hey, what are you learning from this? What are you picking up? We just share what we're learning. We identify 2 or 3 big things for the church to pray for, and we pray. That's kind of our start. And then we move into our business section, which is usually 1 or 2 major agenda items that we're going to have pretty robust conversation about. And we might have a couple of quick updates on things at the end, and then we spend some time in prayer at the end, so kind of bookended by prayer.
Total time
is 3 hours, 2.5 to 3 hours. Another habit we do as a team that I think is an important habit for your, especially as your elder team gets bigger, we will assign a couple of elders to work on projects, like committee work almost. And so we'll call them project teams. And a lot of times they're working on that project with some other members of our church. So projects, I made a note here of projects we have going right now that elders are. So the point is a subset of the elder team can work on this on behalf of the elders and just report back what's going on. And that way you don't have to have all the elders working on all of the subjects. So we have a team of us who's doing our facility search right now. 2 elders are on that and 2 you know, 2 just members of the body are on that. So there's 4 people on that team, 2 of them are elders. We have another team that's developing our youth ministry program, both a vision and a plan for it. We have 2 elders on that team, and we have about 5 members of the body that are working on that. So that's a team of seven, two elders are represented. So this pastoral care plan that we actually have now implemented, that was one elder working with one staff person on it. So we do things like we're actually getting ready to do a kind of a review of our corporate worship. We'll have two elders working with a couple of our worship leaders on it. And then they just report back to the elder team on what they're learning and what the plans are. And, you know, everyone kind of speak into it when they report back. But then the work gets parceled out. So every elder doesn't have to work on every single thing, you know, all the time. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's not quite that big. Yeah. Yeah, your decision-making team can't be much bigger than maybe nine. I'm getting used to the dynamic of seven, and I will tell you, seven voices is a lot already. I mean, it's a lot at a decision-making level. They about worked me to death when we went through that financial thing. They beat up our presentation and information over and over again. I was like, guys, this just, you added 3 days of work to my plate. It was like a great, like, we're good at going back and assessing, hey, we just went through this. How do we work together as a team during that? And I was able to say, at the end, when we assessed that, I said, well, I'll just tell you this. Processing through all of your input, I've got two lawyers on that team. Processing through all of your input and all of your, you know, like, changing this word to this word in the letter that's going out, I was like, God, it about wore me out. I'm just telling you, it about wore me out. It was 3 days of work. So, you know, we're able to kind of talk. I'm still getting used to the dynamic of seven. But I think there comes a place where if you're going to have a decision-making team, which this is the weird thing, you need that team. You need a decision-making team that's small enough to make decisions. And I think the less it's a voting team and the more it's a listening and discerning the voice of the Spirit and where we can come to a unified decision, the better that is. You just can only be so big. So you need a decision-making team for your church. And you need more shepherding capacity than you can have men at the organizational decision-making table. So you're going to have to find... You're going to have to decide, what are you going to build that team for? And we're going to build it for overall organizational leadership of the church, the oversight function of eldering. Now, does that mean we have... I don't know the answer to this next question, these questions I'm asking now. Does that mean that we have... does that mean we have another team of elders that's shepherding only elders and they're not the decision-making team? Does that mean that we cap it at nine and we rotate guys through? I'll tell you the models I'm seeing out there, and you can just, these are like options, ways that this is being approached by people. One model I'm seeing is kind of a two board model, which is a decision making team of seven, eight, nine men, and then and then another team that could be much bigger that's handling shepherding issues. The best way I've actually seen that work is that the whole elder team together, the shepherds and the decision-making team, together they decide who should be on the decision-making team. They have some way of deciding that collectively. So what's awesome about that to me is that the whole team gets to decide which of our guys are we going to empower to make the organizational decisions. So even if they don't get to be in the decision-making meeting, they've at least been in the process of commissioning the men that they're going to entrust with those decisions. So I think that's pretty good. I think that's a pretty good solution to that. All that speaks to you've got to trust every man on your elder team, even if it's a two-layer team. If you have a guy on there who you think, well, I would never want him making organizational decisions. I wouldn't put him on the elder team to begin with, even if it's just a shepherding elder team. So, because he's, even if he's going to be deciding who gets to be on the decision-making team, you want men deciding that who at least have some conception of what that team does and appreciation for what it does. So that's one model I'm seeing. Another model I'm seeing is a team that's always 8, 9, 10. I've seen up to a dozen men, and the elders have rotations. They have, you know, they have, it's a three, you serve a 2-year or maybe a 3-year term, and they stagger some of this. So every year they've got 2 or 3 guys that are rotating off the team. And that works really well in churches that are doing the other leadership development well. And so what they have a lot of times is they have a big pool of men to which they can choose and select and discern from to build an elder team. So they would say, man, we always have 100 guys. I mean, I talked to a mega church pastor who I think does this really well. This is not a famous mega church pastor, which there's a lot of those, by the way. You've never heard of them, and they're leading churches of thousands and thousands of people. And he was like, man, I would tell you at any given time we have 100 guys in our church who could serve capably on a big-picture decision-making elder team for our church. And so we just know that's the case, and the way our current elders look at it, and we have 3 that rotate off every year, so every year we got to have 3 new elders. And if a guy needs to step off because of life circumstance or stuff, that's okay because we've got guys that can fill his role. So the way our elder team always looks at it is we're trying to discern which of these 100 men the Spirit is raising up right now to serve in the eldership role. And they have a process of spiritual discernment where they pray together. They will together nominate men from the body. This is behind closed doors, so it's not like everyone knows who was nominated. They'll just put names on the table, and any one of the current 9 or 10 elders can just say, "I'm not comfortable with him," and that's it. He's not considered anymore. So you don't have to say why you're not comfortable. You can just say, "I have a check. I'm not comfortable." And so this is a process they go through by which they just discern where the Spirit is leading them in a unified fashion. And then he said, we'll whittle that down to 5 or 6 guys. We'll go talk to them and figure out which 2 or 3 are ready to serve as elders. I mean, that's one process. So the 2 models I'm seeing is one is kind of two kinds of boards, and the shepherding board can be pretty large, and then the corporate decision-making board is smaller. And then another model I'm seeing is it's always one board of manageable size with an understanding there's a lot of men in the church who could probably fit the qualifications, and together they're going to discern which men to invite into that larger team. What has to be present at either case is a lot of humility. And I think when you foster a way for your elder qualified men to know that there's an opportunity, but we also have this reality that we can't have 50 people on our elder team at one time, or on our decision-making board at one time. And then you have a clear way of discerning the leading of the Spirit. I think godly men can trust that. Yeah.
Can you scale this down a few notches for
us? Yeah.
Thinking of like ministry and initiative and the way staff and elder leadership work together, when you've got a few elders and maybe 1.5 technical staff and a bunch of volunteers and schedules and all that.
How
can it work in a somewhat efficient manner?
Yeah. I would get in the habit of doing some kind of planning process regardless of how big you or small you are. I think that discipline is really good for a church, even if your planning is simple. It's like, we're going to plan the sermon series, we're going to plan the key ministry initiatives. For the staff to know what they're freed up to do, even if there's 2 of them, without going back to the elders constantly is already sets you up for growth and success. So I would have some kind of process. I mean, it could just be And it could even be like a weekend away where we're going to, if it's small, we have 3 elders and 2 staff. All 5 of us are going to go away for a weekend. We're going to make the ministry plan for the year. The staff are going to know what they're empowered to do. It could be something that simple. So I would always have that habit. And then I think when you're smaller, your elders tend to be more involved. They tend to almost be like working like pseudo-volunteer staff. And that's okay if you need them to be at that level. This is not just true of churches. This is true of any organization. I'm on the board of a nonprofit that we started 3 years ago. It's a faith and work initiative. I didn't start it. The 2 guys who started it just came to me and asked me to be on the board of it. And so I'm on the board of it. And when we started, we had 1 staff guy, and we had a board of 6. And the board did so much work. It was like planting a church. I mean, we were showing up to host events, and we were doing a lot of the work of that ministry and that mission. We've hired staff. We've grown it. We've hired staff. We have 4 full-time staff now. We are transitioning now to be more of an oversight and direction-giving board. And the staff, you know, gets to run the thing. So all that to say, that ministry would have never gotten off the ground if the board members weren't really, really involved in doing the mission. I mean, it's as simple as we're having a fundraising dinner tonight. We all got to be there and set up chairs and, you know, greet people at the door. Because, I mean, we started this thing, and we got to raise $50,000. So let's all be there, all hands on deck. So your church might be the same way. If you have 1 pastor or 2 staff and the church is growing, then you really might need your elders to be really involved in a lot of the ministry of the church, stuff that would later be handed off to staff that for right now we need volunteer labor and the elders have to be there and do it. Yeah. And in an ideal world, I like to see a church plant start with a plurality of elders. In an ideal world, I like to see at least a couple. But if that's not the case, and you have outside elders or some kind of oversight board from outside, I think that's a great habit to have accountability and hopefully. It's men you actually trust to speak into what you're doing so that you just need that. We all need people speaking into what we're doing in order to lead well. We always do. So if our default position is like oversight and the elder team is like if my default position is the elder team is someone I've got to kind of manage so they don't get in my business too much. Well, that's not going to be healthy. I mean, I actually need them. I need their perspective. If they're godly men, I need their input. I need them to look at our church. So I think it's the same way if you have an outside oversight board. You need them as much as you can to speak into what you're doing and to review it and help you make wise decisions. And then when it comes to transitioning into bigger eldership team, I would probably go back to what am I doing to develop leaders in the life of our church? I would probably start there and see if that can't get you some men that get closer and closer to elder qualified before you ever have the elder conversation with them. So you can watch them. And let's be honest, some men get weird as soon as the elder conversation is introduced, right? They start trying to act like an elder or look a certain way. So the more you can not introduce that conversation, you can actually just see who's ministering because this ministry captures their heart and they're growing as disciples of Jesus. So developing leaders, then you might to get a couple of guys elder qualified, you might have to do some last training push specifically to get them elder qualified. So it may be, you know, some theological stuff you have to study, or you need to train them more in depth on your vision and your DNA, stuff like that. But I would try to get some men as far along before I introduce the conversation. So when you introduce the conversation, you already have a pretty high degree of trust and confidence in them. And so that even if the conversation gets to eldership's not a good fit, you're pretty confident in how they would handle that. Yeah. And then the process of introducing them as candidates to your body and having your body give input can be a great last check for you kind of before you appoint elders. All right? We good? One last thing I want to give you is just a little bit of what I think makes for a really good elder team as you're kind of building a team. And we've talked about a lot of this, so I'll just kind of finish it by making it clear. You need a unified vision, which is that theological vision of how you want to see church and ministry done. You probably need to be pretty on the same page in that respect. You don't want to be having core philosophical agreements. You need to have answered things like, what level of theological precision do we want at our elder team level? You need to have answered that. You need to have answered things like, is it okay if some of our elders are premillennial and some are amillennial and postmillennial? You need to have answered stuff like that, okay? Not, even if you don't think that's important, you need to know why it's not important, and you need to know why it's not an issue to argue about, or if you do think it's important, you need to know why it's important, okay? So you need to have that. And if you kind of lay, Keller has in his book, Center Church, he has some great questions about theological vision that I think if you answer these questions, what you get is you get a differentiated church. So your whole church takes on that posture of differentiation. It's distinct from your culture, and it's probably distinct among churches too. It's not just any old kind of church. It's a church with a particular personality. So you have a differentiated presence. Your church itself has a differentiated presence. You want your elders to have the nerve to maintain that DNA while they lead from it. So unified vision. You need a diversity of gifting on your elder team, and I would look for a diversity of gifting. And I think this is a little bit of a blind spot in our network. I think we will. The two things I tend to see a lot are elder teams that are overly weighted toward guys who love theology, or elder teams that are overly weighted toward kind of priestly men who love to shepherd and care for others, or elder teams that are overly weighted toward guys who like to preach and teach. So you also need guys who can think who think mission. You need guys who think about organizations and how organizations function. You need guys who are passionate about pastoral care. You need the theological standards guys. You need all of those on your team. So I think the football team is the best analogy. You need a lot of different kind of players. The traps I've seen we've fallen into or I've seen. Too many idea people. Idea people, or everyone's got a new creative idea. We could do this, we could do this, we could do this. Man, you get too many of those people and not enough executors. That's you never get anything done. You just have ideas. That's a problem I fall into. You need to be careful of having too many safety men. You need one or two safety men on your elder board, meaning their default position is protect, make sure this is right, make sure this is safe. We have two guys like that on our elder team now. I don't think we need any more. Okay, two's good. I want a creative tension on our elder team, and I have this now. I got a couple of guys whose default is safety and evaluation, and then I've got a couple of guys whose default is let's go for it. Let's advance this thing, and I love that tension. I love that tension. So I actually set our elder team up for robust conversations. And we had that. We had one this weekend at our elder retreat that was awesome. And I'm like, I know how this is going to go. I'm going to throw an idea out there that's creative and outside the box, and our mission. Let's go, guys, are going to be so excited. They're not even going to ask any hard questions. They're going to be, and then I've got two guys who I know are going to be like, wait a minute. So it was fun. You need that. And so you just need a good, you need a good mix. When you get unified vision, this is what you're able to do. When you get those creative tension conversations, you're able to fall back to, sometimes I do this as the referee. But guys, we all want the same thing, which is this is our mission. This is what we're about. Boom, 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 boom. We're all pulling on the same, we all want to go in the same place. You get some pretty good decisions. You need clarity about where the elder team fits in the organization, which we've talked a ton about, and that changes as things grow. So for us right now, it's big picture directional decisions and shifts, overall spiritual health, messy pastoral care. I'm the go-between. And then you just need a bias toward having hard conversations. Like you need men who are confident, differentiated, and humble enough that they can have robust conversations, they can disagree, they can challenge each other, and at the end of the day, we love each other and we're all on the same mission.